all these years, I thought I knew you, but you turned out to be a stranger.
We are fighting for our lives, Anne. My family must survive.
Yes, the most shocking experience of their lives. Doubly shocking because it can happen to you.
Stay away from that trailer.
What are you gonna do, call the cops? They're busy. We're the new highway patrol.
Derek!
The lawless are on the loose, making it necessary for law-abiding citizens to make their own law.
When I get going, fire a shot over the heads. Maybe that'll upset them.
Right.
There are no civilians. We are all at war.
Give me a gun. I'm good with a gun. I'll stay here and I'll kill them.
This is civilization's jungle. After the jackals of society have ruthlessly ravaged it, ending the world of decency.
Wasn't a good enough shot.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Cue the appropriate music. No, no, no. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And thank you very much, Michael H. Price, editor, artist, writer of many things. Just check out Amazon.com, Michael H. Price. I sometimes just do that just to be amazed by the amount of stuff that you have out there.
No, we just don't know when to quit.
No, we don't. And it's kind of an obsession with us, isn't it? And I'm so glad to see Forgotten Horrors 9 doing so well on Amazon. And we want to, if anybody's interested in these podcasts that might want to get it on, get the same sort of whatever it is that we do here in print, Forgotten Horrors 9 is a pretty good place to go, I think. And we do some beach party things on it.
I guess all the books are a pretty good jumping in place.
Yes, absolutely.
If you want to start chronologically, there's volume one right there. But I find that a lot of people come to the series like in midstream. And probably because the period covered in, say, Volume 4, the wartime and post-war period, or Volume 6, the rock and roll horror era, you know, those would be like favorite areas of certain readers, and then they seem to find themselves drawn back and forth throughout the series. It's like I say, we really don't know where to quit, and although technically the series cuts off at 1985 and the arrival of Blood Cult from Tulsa, being the basically the picture that kind of put the grindhouses out of business.
That's exactly right.
In many ways.
Or brought the grindhouses into your living room.
Right, exactly. Yeah. In other words, for such a purportedly modest film, Blood Cult is so audacious that not only does it work on its own terms, but it also instituted a sea change.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you say what you will about who made the first made-for-video motion picture feature. All evidence points to that one little videotape production.
Out of shot on a half-inch beta in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and released in United Entertainment.
Beta.
Yeah, broadcast beta.
Exactly. And that fascinates me because it does bring full circle the notion that it was the low-budget or Poverty Row studios of the late 20s and early 30s that completely gerrymandered the boundaries of the horror genre.
Exactly. And, you know, we even talked about one of those in deep Poverty Row, and that was Son of Ngaji.
Oh, didn't we, though?
You know, I mean, that's...
I think we talked that one to death gave it more than its due. but doggone it, you know, those cheapest of the cheap pictures have a staying power that a lot of Oscar bait never will touch.
They do, and I'm still at a loss to quite understand why. I can accept it, I just can't quite understand it.
Yeah, exactly.
But it doesn't really make any difference, which really kind of brings us to this picture, and the picture we're talking about today is Panic in Year Zero, an American international film released, I believe, with Tales of Terror on a double bill. Is that correct?
I believe that's the way I saw it first.
Yeah. And it is, I tell you, that I knew there was something going on with this picture when Joey Hambrick, our producer, his wife Emily, watches some of these films with us, not always enthusiastically, but she watched this one and she said, you know, in the past year or two of the films that you guys have watched and talked about, that was like a real film. And in some ways, I understand perfectly what she's talking about there.
It
was a real film, and it was, and we got real train noise now too coming through. The train's coming through.
Hey, that's great. That brings it all home.
That does bring it all home. But one of the things I was fascinated by, Michael, was its parallels to Grapes of Wrath, which I think is one of my all-time favorite pictures, right up there with Freaks and White Christmas and Rock and Roll High School. There's so many parallels here. You've got a family in a vehicle escaping something awful, hitting the road in America, and trying to survive with the notion at the very beginning that the family has to get through. I mean, that's what the whole thing of Grapes of Wrath is. Now, in Grapes of Wrath, that changes, and mostly through the viewpoint of the Jane Darwell character, Ma Jode, you see that the family becomes the family of man and all of this sort of thing, and there's some lofty. We don't have that in Panic in Year Zero, but we have these amazing parallels. For one thing, we have O.C. Whitehead in this picture playing a hardware store owner who was Al Jode in original Grapes of Wrath.
There you go.
And so you've got the group getting out, the family getting out, the family is all, the family trying to survive. You've got a scene, when I saw it, it gave me goosebumps. The scene in which Ray Milland and his family are trying to get, or the Ray Milland character and his family are trying to get to another town, and there's a little group of people across the road with guns, clubs, not letting anyone through. It is exactly parallels the scene with the Okies.
It's a capsule of Steinbeck, and of course, this movie comes 22 years after John Ford directed The Grapes of Wrath.
Yes.
It not only encapsulates John Steinbeck, but it does so in a way that reminds me particularly of Woody Guthrie's Ballad of Tom Joad.
Yes, exactly. Tell me more about that.
The conciseness of telling the story. I mean, you don't get the full value of The Grapes of Wrath unless you've read the novel and seen the John Ford picture.
Yes, I agree.
But you get a kind of a really good sort of a Classics Illustrated version in Woody Guthrie's song, which occurred very close in time to the novel and the film.
That's right. As a matter of fact, I believe he was inspired by the film to write it, if I'm not mistaken.
That's my understanding. And of course, the inspiration, if you can call something so dire an inspiration, lay in the ecological disaster known as the Dust Bowl.
That's right. That's right.
And what was that brought on by? Well, it wasn't entirely a freak of nature. It was brought on by irresponsible corporate farming practices.
Yes, and exacerbated later by that same thing.
And exacerbated by the industrialists invading agrarian America, in this case Oklahoma, mm-hmm. To further exploit the land and drive the folks who had kind of worked hard to make their homes there, making them homeless.
That's right, and the early part of that with the John Quaylen character Muley is that's when mm-hmm. that's brought home and the flashbacks.
Yeah, they've been tractored out by the cats. What does that mean? Well, it means they've been driven off by force.
That's right, but because the cats are working for, of course, the banks and the people who are reclaiming
the land from the
sharecroppers.
And the earth moving machinery that he refers to was so far. It was like a cat or caterpillar would have been to a plow, roughly what an assault rifle is to a .22 rifle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. Overkill,
made for
basically.
Destruction rather
yes.
than building.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in case people don't know the film, we won't give a lot of it away because it's a very simple film to synopsize. Ray Milland and his family, which includes Gene Hagen and Mary Mitchell, not the Mary Mitchell from Wild One, but another Mary Mitchell, and Frankie Avalon, are going on a little fishing trip up to the mountains of California, and they just get underway when there's a nuclear explosion over Los Angeles, and all of a sudden everything changes. And that's essentially it. It's a tale of survival then after that. And it's really told in very, very human terms. And in a way, Michael, I've been thinking a lot. I've been thinking more about this than I need to. But in a way, this is the anti-Grapes of Wrath. They don't go back and get Gene Hagen's mom, the Gene Hagen character's mm-hmm. mom in Los Angeles. But it's very important in the Grapes of Wrath for them to get Grandma and Grandpa and take them
yes.
with them. They don't. There is none of that family of man aspect in this that I see at all. When Gene Hagen, when the three thugs led by Richard Balkion, who's just great in this, the three thugs confront the family on the road, Ray Milland, or I'm sorry, it was Frankie Avalon shoots one of them, and they're about to do them in, and Gene Hagen talks them out of doing them in. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that sets up later on the reentry of Balkion's gang, which was very detrimental for the family. So you don't have the Grapes of Wrath. You know, you don't have an analog to the scene in which Ma at the Oki camp feeds the kids, right?
It stops with the us versus
yes,
them.
It never gets beyond that.
And Steinbeck, of course, used that, but he resolved it.
He did. He did.
And I think, well, there's a lot of influence. I wouldn't call it stealing from Steinbeck, but
right.
I would call it accepting a great deal of influence.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, Milland had those wonderful old Hollywood connections. What was he doing slumming at American International? Well, he wasn't slumming. He was staying active in the wake of the collapse of the big studio system.
Right, and he had a deal, did he not, where if he directed a picture, they would put him in a picture.
Yeah, exactly, and he found, and of course you see a lot of the influence that Billy Wilder had on Milland in the directing job, which of course Milland handles.
Can you give us a couple of examples of that?
The intensity, the emotional intensity, especially of Lost Weekend.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. which was Milan's big Oscar bait picture. And,
right.
and of course, a lot of people are going to say, well, wow, how the mighty have fallen. Not fallen at all, just coasting along and taking work where work was found and making more of it than what was written. It's also significant that that Roger Corman allowed this thing a running time of over an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm. Now, was Corman involved? How was Corman involved in this?
Corman is the fellow who kind of called the shots at American International, although he was not direct AIP management.
Right, right.
The Milan deal with American International involved Corman.
Mm-hmm.
Corman had substituted Milan for Vincent Price in one of the Edgar Allan Poe pictures.
Sure, Premature Burial, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he's perfectly good, but I think that role still calls for a Vincent Price.
Yeah.
And, of course, then Corman would use Milan in a much more adventurous Corman picture called X, the Man with X-Ray Eyes.
Yes, a very, very metaphorical picture. Yeah,
which is just a real masterpiece of speculative science fiction, coupled with that Poe-like attitude that Corman had absorbed, and then the idea that Sam Arkoff and James Nicholson, they're stewardship of American International was such that they really had bigger things in mind than just making drive-in exploitation pictures.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a it's one of the first disaster movies, I think you could say. Not that there hadn't been disaster movies well before Panic in Year Zero, but the template was struck here for a lot of the great disaster movie scare of the 1970s,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think they selected a political environmental cataclysm in the atomic threat, considerably bigger than say, the tidal waves and collapsing skyscrapers mm-hmm. of the 1970s.
Earthquake and right.
Exactly.
Towering inferno.
Towering Inferno, mm-hmm. exactly. Poseidon Adventure, all perfectly respectable disaster pictures. But what's the ultimate disaster? Well, how about the end of civilization as we know it?
Right, right.
And certainly, Panic in Year Zero points almost directly toward what George Romero would accomplish in 1968 with Night of the Living Dead.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Another,
which is also about survival, isn't it? Yeah.
Right. Another environmental cataclysm
mm-hmm.
that has science fictional origins, unexplained origins,
right.
ultimately.
Right.
And of course, then Romero, as he progressed in his series of Living Dead pictures, would ultimately wind up practically remaking The Grapes of Wrath in a more recent picture called Land of the Dead.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Which also has some very nice paraphrases of Mice and Men.
Yes.
Speaking of Steinbeck,
yes, it does, absolutely. Well, also Lou Russoff is involved here. I think he was the one that had signed Frankie Avalon up. Am I correct on that? Signed him.
That's
with
my understanding.
AIP.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so this is about a year before the Beach Party, before the first Beach Party film. And so they were trying to put him in. They put him in that war picture, what is Operation Bikini, and they put him in the African that African adventure picture, which I can't remember what the name of that. Drums of Africa,
and sure.
And then he went to the Beach Party. But here, he does a pretty good job, I think, of acting. And he was making that transition, the pretty boys from Philadelphia that Dick Clark had championed, Fabian and mm-hmm. Bobby Rydell and Frankie Avalon, all those guys, their kind of music was sort of fading away, and Avalon made that jump, and I think he was quite successful with it.
Avalon can act.
Yes, he
is a director's actor, however, and when he gets a director who merely allows him to be his charming self,
right.
You get pictures like Beach Party.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get a taskmaster director, like Milan proves on Panic in Year Zero, he's stretching.
Yes, he is.
And it's not like he's exhausting himself stretching. It's like he finds the stretch exhilarating. And he can be pretty darned intense.
Yes, he can. And you know, there's a couple of things in there that at the end. There's two soldiers. We won't give away the ending, but there's two soldiers in it, and they again. I kept looking. I guess I'm a huge Steinbeck guy, as you well know. And I kept looking for Grapes of Wrath echoes, and those two soldiers to me echo the two gas station attendants when the Jodes are starting across the desert at night, and they're chewing gum, and they're in their slick little outfits, and it seemed to me again to be another conscious or unconscious kind of homage to the Grapes of Wrath. And then the only thing that you really see. That because Jean Hagen, if you make her the analog of Jane Darwell's character in Grapes of Wrath, she's very ineffectual. She really just is not, you know, does not have much to do. And it's to Milan to say at the end, because at the very end of the Grapes of Wrath, both the novel and the film, you know, Ma is the one who's kept everything together. It's not Pa.
That's
Pa's
right.
Done. And here it's definitely not Ma, it's Pa. And when Pa says in Panic in the Year Zero, after a couple of murders, I looked for the worst in others and found it in myself. That's about as close as we get to, you know, self-exploration or whatever you would want to say in Panic in Year Zero.
Yeah, the self-realization.
That's what it would be.
Like that great scene in a not a similar picture, but a contemporary picture of similar intensity called Lady in a Cage.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Where Ann Southern,
Olivia
right? Is that Ann Southern? No, that's Olivia de Havilland.
It's Olivia de Havilland. Ann Southern has a prominent supporting role.
That's right.
Where Olivia de Havilland realizes that the home invasion crisis that she has endured was caused largely by her own self.
Mm-hmm.
She has that similar reflective moment where she says, "I am a monster."
And it's not really
an exploration of motivations or character depth, but it's nice to see that kind of touch in a picture that a lot of people are going to dismiss as drive-in distraction.
Which they would have done with Panic in Year Zero, because
it was really,
although the AIP genius, as Arkoff once told, I think both you and me, Sam Arkoff, said the idea was instead of having an A picture and a B picture on a double feature, we had two B pictures. But even with that, I think there was the top of the bill and the bottom of the bill, just like in the regular A and B picture. And this was the B picture and the bill with Tales of Terror.
And Arkoff knew that a Vincent Price, Edgar Allan Poe picture with Roger Corman's imprimatur would pull a lot more traffic.
Yes, yes.
So you've got a really good backup picture kind of taking up the rear, that proves to be maybe, I don't know, is it as good a picture as Tales of Terror? There's no comparison.
No,
except
there's
that
no
both
comparison.
Are AIPs.
No.
they're both very rewarding pictures. And I remember, even though my uncle owned the theater and I kind of worked there part time and always got in for free, I felt like I didn't feel like I'd wasted any time, and certainly didn't cost me any money.
Well, I'll tell you, it's a sleeper for sure. This picture, and I really would recommend it. I think it's worth a look. I think it's worth maybe a second look. I do want to give the trivia for the picture for this evening or for today, and that's one of the co-writer Jay Sims. Now there's two writers on the picture. One is John Morton, and I suspect that may be some sort of a pseudonym because that's the only credit I can find for John Morton. But the other writer, Jay Sims, did a lot of TV later on, wrote a lot of TV shows, but he started, Michael, with one of your boys from Texas, Gordon McLendon.
Gordon McClendon.
He wrote both Killer Shrews and Giant Gila Monsters, the Giant Gila Monster, the first two pictures that McClendon, radio pictures, ever released.
Down just 3 years before Panic in Year Zero.
3 years before Panic in Year Zero. That's correct. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's Jay Sims, and he went on to have actually a pretty long career. And I think that, you know, you're always happy when a picture gives you a little more than you expect it to give you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the case with this.
Well, it's certainly worth a rediscovery.
Absolutely it is. Absolutely. Panic in Year Zero.
And the only bad Ray Milland is no Ray Milland.
That's right. That's right. Although I was a little bit disappointed by his autobiography.
Mm, haven't read that.
Wide-Eyed in Babylon. I just read it just mm-hmm. maybe the past 6 months or so, and he doesn't really talk quite as much about the movie-making process as you would like. But I think, mm-hmm. you know, he sounds like a pretty decent guy. And, you know, let's face it, toward the end of his career, he did all right. You know, he could have done worse than what he was doing with Corman and AIP.
No, and he did well in television.
Yes, he did. Absolutely he did, yeah. Yeah, and so, you know, it's one of those stories, and also sometimes when you get those veteran actors directing pictures, you get some very interesting stuff. What did we do just recently, Bed of Fire, with John Hoyt's film? You know, who wrote it and starred in it. He didn't direct it, but he wrote it and starred in it. And, you know, you start getting stuff like that, and it's just, you know, they're kind of seeing what they can get away with a little bit. And what did you think? One more question on that before we close. What did you think about Les Baxter's jazz score in this picture?
I love Les Baxter. His stuff kind of veers toward cheesiness.
Yeah.
But I can tell that his influences are coming out of the right places. I tend to resent the tendency to replace, like, the Black Sabbath score, perfectly good, made in Italy,
mm-hmm.
dramatic underscoring, with Baxter's, I guess today we'd call it lounge music.
Yes, absolutely. He did a lot of lounge music, yeah.
A lot of the exotica feel in it, and I got over that resentment. I mean, both versions of Black Sabbath are available, and mm-hmm. they both bear watching. But generally speaking, I put him on a par with artists, Baxter, that is, on a par with such artists, as Kay Winding.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The great trombonist who mm-hmm. had a very progressive jazz outfit mm-hmm. that still touched back on big band influences,
right.
and certainly Vince Guaraldi, who is if all you've heard out of Vince Guaraldi is the Charlie Brown
right. Christmas,
TV
yeah.
cartoons, mm-hmm. you haven't heard Vince Guaraldi.
Hmm.
They're all coming off that influence that kind of crystallized in Brazil with the bossa nova craze.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then, and of course, Les Baxter, fully the equal of Martin Denny,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and possibly more productive.
He was awfully productive. Yeah, he sure.
Oh yeah.
He did a ton of stuff for mostly AIP, though, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, and it's so refreshing to see a studio that allows an in-house composer to break all the rules of conventional Hollywood scoring.
Well, and I think you did that also. We're getting a little bit far afield here, but the album that you produced with Albert Glasser.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Glasser was another great progressive, and in fact, he was working during this same period.
Yes, he was.
He could be very old-fashioned, or he could be very progressive. And, of course, Glasser did tremendously good work with Bert I. Gordon.
Yes, he sure did.
And of course, it was Glasser who quit scoring films because the studios were putting him under pressure to do rock and roll.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, absolutely.
It's like,
yeah.
Well, that's, and which he considered regressive, not
right.
progressive.
Right, right.
An interesting phenomenon during that period. A lot of really inventive composers of maybe not old Hollywood, but of post-war Hollywood, got out of the business because they didn't like the current musical trends.
Right.
In the pop music field, Spike Jones quit doing comedy records because he declared that rock and roll is a parody of itself. Even though he had made some funny rock and roll records.
He had made some funny rock and roll records. Yeah.
Exactly. So how do you figure that? I have no idea, but yeah, the parallel with Glasser, worked on a couple of Glasser soundtrack projects during the composer's lifetime, and I found him to be a very funny, not self-effacing. I mean, he did a lot of bragging about himself that may or may not have been warranted, but you get the sense that he was really grateful to have had that career.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did you ever deal with Les Baxter at all? Did you ever meet him?
No. Always kept an eye out for his byline, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. And this is a very interesting, very jazzy score in Panic in Year Zero that I think is I've read some reviews that say that it does what good background music is not supposed to do, or good film music is not supposed to do, which calls attention to itself. But I didn't really see that. I thought it was just really well done and had that sense of urgency and that the whole show needed. So I would definitely
fits the tone of the piece.
I would definitely
and,
recommend.
Yeah, exactly. I think Les Baxter probably bears considering in the same light as, say, Henry Mancini.
Yeah, yeah.
Hello, producer Joey Hambrick here. I just wanted to tell you real quick that Forgotten Horrors Volume 9 is up for a Rondo Award. Since 2002, the Rondos have been fandom's only classic horror awards, decided by fans for fans. You can vote at rondoaward.com. It's really easy, and it would mean a lot to us. Thank you.
All right, tell us what you've got going on now. So if people want to go to Amazon.com and look you up, what might they find that's new?
Oh man! Well, I'm still pretty big on the first volume of Deep in the Horrors of Texas,
yes.
the comic book anthology.
Yeah, glad to be
but
a part
I'm even
of
bigger
that,
on the which has your wonderful Conan.
Yes,
not exactly a lampoon,
not
but
exactly.
Certainly a very much a. In fact, it's almost an official Conan story. And then the sequel, Volume 2, will contain that wonderful thing that you did with Jim Milway and mm-hmm. Rand Holmes for Dennis Kitchen's company called Slide Center Slide.
Yeah, I'm very proud of that story.
Which is like a kind of an Oklahoma Plains Faust.
Well, thank you. It's certainly got a lot of theology in it, for better or for worse. Well, good. Well, we've got, and we want to remind people also that we have on Amazon, and Joey, I always have to ask you about this, Bill Boyce Money Actor. Where is that, and how can people, we've had some people downloading it, we understand. What's it on?
It's on Prime Video.
Prime Video on Amazon, right?
Yes.
No, it's Amazon Prime Video. And that's a documentary, of course, on the star of the Slime People, who was a friend of both mine and Joey's for several years, for the last several years of his life. And we would like for you to take a look at that if you are so inclined. I think the price is right. Was it like 99 cents or something?
It's $1.
It's $1. Okay. Well, we I'll say right now, if you get it and it's not worth $1, just let us know here at the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, and we'll send you your dollar back. Well, Michael, thank you. It's always great to visit, and we'll be doing it again before you know it. And I think this was one of the pictures. I was really glad to see this picture, and really, it's been on my mind, and the whole Grapes of Wrath thing is on my mind, so... Hope you folks are listening. I hope you enjoyed hearing this particular rabbit chase. We'll be back with more.
Lovely.
Thank you, Michael.